This is Angela Ewing with KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio. This is 9 O'Clock Horses, Episode 2. In just minutes, Pauline had hustled me out of the house. We walked quickly along the dark street toward her friend Nancy's house around the corner. The light from my sister's flashlight made a narrow path for us to follow. She told me we must never speak to anyone about my father having a gun. When I asked her why, she said he would be taken away to prison because it was against the law. "How did he get it from the man at work, then?" I asked. "The American pilot sold it to him. Everybody has a gun in America." Nancy's mother made us comfortable with some blankets on the floor of the living room of her house for us. I heard my sister crying as she told Nancy about the gun. Nancy's mother heard Pauline, but all she could say was, "Oh dear, you'd better keep this to yourselves, you know. It wouldn't do for all the neighbors to hear about it." I was scared when I went back home the next morning, relieved when my father met me at the door. "Here's your gas mask, dear," he said. "Off to school now. Your mother's not well, and she's going to spend the day in bed." It was obvious my father was not about to indulge me with any explanation of the events of the night before. When I got home from school, Mum was busy making a cake. She seemed fine, better than she had been for a long time. However, I noticed when I went into the living room, there was a small round hole in the ceiling. The plaster around it looked like a spider's web. I realized then why I had heard the bang so loudly. The living room was directly, almost directly, beneath my bedroom. I asked my sister about it when she came up to bed that night. She told me Mum had taken the gun from the bookshelf and it had gone off. "Why did she do that?" I asked. "Dad told us not to touch it." Pauline sat up in bed, hugging her knees. "She wanted to kill herself." "What? Why?" I asked. "I don't know. How should I know?" She sounded almost hysterical, and I could see the tears glistening on her face. I said, "I know what it is. She doesn't like us anymore." "Oh, don't be daft. That's not it." "Well," I said, almost in tears, "I don't think she likes me as much as you or Doug." "Listen, Amelia. Our mum stood in line for hours at the shop downtown at Christmas last year to buy your nice doll. It's wartime, you know. There aren't many toys anymore. She needn't have done that, you know. No, it's this damn war, and she really misses our Doug." My brother Douglas was the only one in our family to be evacuated from Leicester. Earlier, in 1939, 3 million children were taken from cities and towns that the government assumed would be highly vulnerable to Nazi raids. The evacuee operation was called Pied Piper. All over Britain, children were shipped out like luggage on trains, with a label attached to their jacket, a gas mask, and a change of clothing. At the chosen destination, children were lined up in the local village hall, and hosts were invited to take their pick of the children. The phrase, "I'll take that one," became etched into many a child's memory, probably forever. A second wave of evacuees in 1942 included my brother, who ended up with a family in the country village of Evesham in Worcestershire. I was considered too young. My sister was apparently too valuable to our family as a helper around the house. Douglas was a middle child and an age when authorities deemed to be independent without too much supervision. Perhaps they figured at least one child in our family would be saved from the ever-present danger of an air raid. Wind whipped the naked branches of the old hawthorn tree across the front windows of the house. The side gate to the backyard slammed shut, opened and slammed shut again. My mother was imbibing in her third glass of sherry. She had turned the radio up loudly to listen to a report on the war. She seemed enamored by the propaganda program. "Germany calling, Germany calling." It was intended to deflate the resolve of the British people, to fill them with news that Britain was being wiped out, to lower their morale. Aircraft were being shot out of the sky. British ships were being sunk and casualties were rising. A British spy who called himself Lord Haw-Haw was the educated voice the Germans used nightly. My mother listened to every word. When she turned off the radio, she said, "If we're alive tomorrow, it'll be a miracle." She added, "Your father's wrong. We're all going to die, you know. There's a 250,000 people homeless now in London. We'll be next, or dead." The wind kicked up again, slamming the side gate back and forth. My mother poured another glass of sherry. "For God's sake, Amelia, go outside and latch that damn gate, will you? It's driving me daft." So I stood on the stool in the hall and reached up for my woolen coat, hanging on the coat stand. It was my sister's old coat, and it had a hole at the elbow that had been darned over and over. As I closed the front door behind me, I looked around the garden. Everywhere was so light. It was a full moon, stars bright and brittle in the night sky, glittering pinpoints of light, a phenomenon rarely seen in the industrial, smog-filled city of Leicester, where the 30 factory chimneys belch black smoke 24 hours a day. Only when there was a strong wind were we able to see the sky. When I heard the crunch of gravel on the bath, I turned to see Mr. Johnson, the night warden from down the street. He was Scottish, and I knew his voice well. "Is that you, Amy?" he said. It seemed he couldn't get his tongue around Amelia. He always called me Amy. "Yes, I'm trying to get this gate to stay closed," I said. "Your dad needs to fix this," he said. "The latch is bust. Let's see if we can wedge it shut for now with something." He picked up a large rock from the rockery. "That should do it," he said. "By the way, I came to see you folks because there's a chink of light coming from the front bedroom window. Got to keep those blackout curtains closed tight, all right. We don't want those jerry planes to see us, do we now?" "Right," I said, "and thank you for helping with the gate." He said good night, then turned back to me. "How's your ma? Your sister? You heard from your brother?" "Fine. Mum's fine. Pauline's at night school tonight. She's taking typing lessons. We haven't heard from Douglas." Suddenly there was a hum in the air like a swarm of bees. The humming grew loud, and then the air was vibrating with the drone of engines above us. We both looked up. The sky was black with hundreds of planes moving steadily overhead, droning on and on for a long time. Mr. Johnson took off his hat. He looked heavenwards. "They're ours. Thank God they're ours. Look at 'em all. Poor buggers. I wonder how many of them will come home." He raised his hand to his mouth and yelled into the night. "Godspeed, lads," he said. "Godspeed." I was still listening to the drone until it finally faded away. "Are they all going to Germany?" I asked. "Oh, yes. Aye. Every night they go out. But tonight, well, the poor blighters in Berlin won't get much sleep with that lot." "Why did they go out tonight?" I asked. "Everybody can see them. It's so bright like day." "Aye, lass," he said, his voice slightly hushed. "Aye. It's a bomber's moon, all right. A bomber's moon." I thanked the man again and watched his tall figure stride away, still looking up. Just as I turned to go inside, I glanced down the street, since the next-door neighbour was now gone. It was just a pile of rubble. I had a clear view of the front door of Mrs. Mansfield's house, the blonde-haired lady who always wore very red lipstick. The door opened and a shaft of light cut across the lawn. In the light, I saw a familiar figure step out of the house. It was my father. I stood there transfixed as he put his arms around the woman and kissed her on the lips. I blinked, wondering if the light was playing tricks. Surely it wasn't my dad. For a long moment, I stared at both of them, unable to comprehend. As I turned to go into the house, I looked up at our bedroom window. The chink of light Mr. Johnson had mentioned suddenly disappeared as the curtains were pulled together. My heart sank. Could my mother possibly have witnessed the same scene? When I went back in, she was coming down the stairs. She said not a word to me. that night. There was a terrible row between my parents. They didn't even bother to send me to bed before my mother set upon my father. "I saw you with that tramp," she yelled. My father tried to calm her down. "Vicky, let's talk about this some other time, and it's not what you think either." "What is it then?" she said. Her eyes were wild. "What trivial little tale are you going to drum up to cover your arse?" My father literally pushed my mother into her chair. "Listen carefully," he said, leaning over her. "Christine Mansfield has just lost her son. She had a telegram today. You know, I've always been a friend of hers and her husband before he went to war. Now he's dead. And now Timmy. She had to tell somebody. She asked me in. For God's sake, I was just comforting the poor woman." I gave her a hug. What's so bad about that? Yes, I gave her a kiss too. My mother stared at him for a minute before she rose and pushed him out of the way. She went to the door. "I'm going to bed." My father sat down at the table and opened the newspaper in front of him. Then he pushed it away. He leaned his elbows on the table and held his head in his hands. I went to him and reached up to touch his cheek. I felt his warm tears on my hand. In 1944, Hitler manufactured a rocket called the V-2. Unlike the other bombs that were sent off from Germany across the Channel, designed to run out of fuel and just drop out of the sky, destroying whatever lay below, rockets were a thing of the future. More damage was done by the V-2 than any other bomb so far. Already most of Coventry was destroyed. And Leicester, being very close to that city and the most industrial, suffered destruction beyond compare. My mother had sunk into a deep depression and again became distant. Her beloved brother Leonard had been killed recently during the Normandy invasion, and our sister Irene had been visiting a friend in London and was caught and killed in an air raid. She wouldn't talk to us. To me, the silence she bestowed upon us was more of a weapon than Hitler's bombs. Perhaps because my sister was older and more involved in her many activities at work and at night school, she didn't notice as much as I did. But I was left alone often to worry and wonder what I had done wrong. Then one day, something happened to change my world completely. I attended Hamling Infant School every day. We weren't used to many daytime raids anymore. But we knew the drill when we heard the sirens warning of bombers coming our way. We were hustled along to the shelter built adjacent to the school building. It was a room built underground with benches along the walls. Shelves were equipped with extra gas masks and torches, canned food and other goods. When we got to the shelter, we felt a slight tremor, but no explosion. It seemed this time the German planes had gone over without dropping any bombs. Or so we thought. The teacher told us the lessons were over for the day and we should go home. It was earlier than usual, about 2 o'clock. I ran down the street, my gas mask in its little box swinging from my shoulder. No one went anywhere without their gas masks, just in case the Germans used gas bombs. My sister told me when I was an infant I was put into a special cradle-type box with a gas mask attached. What a chore it must have been for everyone to never forget to carry their gas masks, which were to be carried as a shoulder bag everywhere they went. I had not known anything different, so for me, as an 8-year-old, it was just what we had to do. I was almost home when I noticed several men in uniform on the park opposite the house. They were busy constructing a rope fence of some kind around what appeared to be a hole in the ground, although I couldn't see exactly. One of the men must have seen me looking because he came over the road to me. "You live here?" he asked. "Yes." "See that circle where the fence is being put up?" "Yes." "Now you don't go nosing around that fence, all right?" "Why?" "It's very dangerous. Just stay away, all right?" "Yes," I said, not understanding anything. I walked to the front door, turning back every few minutes, trying to see what was going on over the road. When I got there, I found the front door locked. I was home earlier than usual. So, of course, I assumed Mum might be shopping or she might be asleep. I knocked again and decided she must be out. For a few minutes, I sat down on the big stone in the rockery to wait. I knew there was a key hanging on a nail behind the letterbox in the front door. But I wasn't tall enough to reach it, so I walked back to the front gate to watch the men on the park. I noticed Mrs. Mansfield was standing in her garden smoking a cigarette. She was looking at the busy scene opposite, too. I had a notion she wouldn't mind reaching the key for me so I could let myself into the house. Mrs. Mansfield was a pretty lady, I thought. She was always nice to me, although since the row between my mum and dad about her, we hadn't seen much of her. She said hello to me when I went up to her gate. I asked her what was going on the park. "Oh, it's an unexploded bomb, but don't worry, pet. They'll get the experts in tomorrow and take care of it." "Could it go off now?" I asked, suddenly afraid. "I told you, pet, they have it all under control." When I asked her if she would come and reach for the key to my house, she said, "Of course she would." She stubbed out her cigarette on the path as we went to the front door. "Your mum out, is she?" she asked. "She must be," I said. Within a moment, she had pulled the key on the piece of string through the letterbox and opened the door. "There you are, pet," she said, stepping back. We both must have smelled the gas at the same time, because she stood still for a minute before stepping into the hall. "Your mama's gone out and left the gas on. Best we switch that off." She looked down at me and laughed. "Good job I didn't bring my fag in with me. We could have all gone sky high with this much gas. Can you open some windows, pet, while I get to the kitchen?" I was about to open the window in the living room when I heard Mrs. Mansfield. "Bloody hell," she yelled. I stood by at the door to the kitchen and saw my mother with her head resting on the edge of the gas stove. Her eyes were closed. Mrs. Mansfield raced over to my mother and knelt down beside her. She looked up at me. "Get that door wide open," she said, as she switched off all the burners, "and get some wet towels right now." I picked up the tea towel from the rail by the sink, stood on tiptoe and managed to reach the tap. Mrs. Mansfield said, "Now, you get on your knees and wipe your mum's face. Don't stop. I'm going to my house to telephone for an ambulance." "Well, Pauline will be home soon," I said. "Shouldn't we wait for her?" "Best we get some help now, pet." I knelt by my mother, wiping her face as I was instructed, not knowing what was happening. The smell of gas was still overpowering, strong, and I wondered if she was dead. But she suddenly opened her eyes and looked at me as though she had never seen me before in her life. She took a deep breath, and then suddenly, like an animal in distress, she let out a long, drawn-out cry that sent chills up my spine. I wanted to run out of the house. This was my mother. My mother, who I realized only at that moment, was trying to kill herself again. I put my arms around her, even though she didn't speak to me. Pauline had just come home. The ambulance had arrived outside the house. I told her what Mrs. Mansfield and I had found when I came early from school because of the air raid. Pauline hugged me. She said, "Well, looks like for once this man Hitler saved a life. You wouldn't have come home if there hadn't been an air raid. Then where would we be?" "Without a mum," I said. "Yes, that's right." That afternoon, my mother was taken away in an ambulance. Not to the hospital, but to the mental institute on the edge of town. The Towers Hospital, locally referred to by the local kids as the loony bin. This is Angela Ewing with Storytime. You have been listening to episode 2 of 9 O'Clock Horses. Stay tuned for episode 3 next week. Thank you for listening to Curry Coast Community Radio, your community-supported radio station. If you like this program and want to hear more like it, consider supporting Curry Coast Community Radio by volunteering your time or contributing to our capital campaign to help us get on the air. For more information, go to our website, kciw.org.